Hi, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Southern Fried Podcast, a production of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Got an author, but Porter Briggs is much more than just an author. He is, those ads, the world's most interesting man. Porter, you may be the world's most interesting man. You've had an interesting journey through the decades.
Well, I've been blessed, and it has been an interesting journey. It wasn't one that I planned, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. Your book is called South Towards Home, An Unexpected Love Story. What led you to sit down and write a book?
Well, I was 78, about to turn 79.
Yeah.
And then I said, in 1 year, I'm going to be
80. Porter is not a young author.
A young author. I said, in 1 year, I'm going to be 80. And when you're 80, you're officially old. And so I thought, and everybody had been telling me I should write about my adventures, mm-hmm. or whatever you want to call them. So I said, if I'm going to do it, I better do it now, because before long, I'm going to die. Because, you know, you get to be 80, you think about the end.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So where does your story begin?
Well, I thought a long time about where to begin.
Yeah, where do you start it? Yeah.
And so I decided that to start it when I began my adult life. And I didn't feel like I was an adult when I got out of college. Even when I went in the Army, I didn't feel like I was an adult. But they sent me to Germany, and I landed at my unit. And they put me on a helicopter and flew me out into this great big forest in the middle of nowhere. And the crew chief on the helicopter said, Lieutenant, we're going to have to drop you here. It's 4 clicks. That's kilometers, about 2.5 miles. It's about 4 clicks from the unit. You're going to have to go to make it on foot from there. That's when my adult life began.
Wow.
They put me out. It was 7 degrees. And I had to walk with the map. The Germany has big forests.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And
huge forests.
They put me in an open field in the middle of 7 degrees. I had to walk alone 4 kilometers. I had a compass and a map. The crew chief gave me a map.
Yeah.
Said,
yeah.
We're here. They're 18th. That was my unit, is here. And, you know, it's 230 degrees. So I had my compass and off I went. That was when my adult life began. And that's when the book begins.
Okay. That makes sense. For our listeners, though, why don't you give us a little bit about your growing up, where you're from, where you went to school, so forth.
I was born in Little Rock,
right,
St. Vincent's Infirmary. Yeah. My father was the first pediatrician in Arkansas.
See, I think that's fascinating. Yeah, the state's first pediatrician.
First one. He started in 1938.
Wow.
And married my mother 2 years later, I guess, after he started. She was from Hope. She grew up in Hope. And her first husband, who was a doctor in Nashville, died of nephritis when they had a son. He was 8 months old, and she was a widow.
Mm-hmm.
She came to Little Rock, and then 2 years later, she and my father married and had me.
Wow.
So I grew up here and went to public school the whole way through. And I was a senior in high school the year of the integration crisis.
1957, 58.
I graduated in 58.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm a full-blown Little Rocker.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so. And then college where?
My first semester I went to Vanderbilt, but I didn't like Vanderbilt. It's a long story, but anyway,
gotcha.
after one semester, I decided to transfer to Arkansas. The main problem with Vanderbilt was that there weren't many girls there.
Understood.
And so
had your priorities straight.
I did. I had my priorities absolutely straight. So off I went to Fayetteville, and then I was at the University of Arkansas for 3.5 years and graduated.
All right. So the book starts when you become an adult, and that's when you're off serving tank maneuvers during the Cold War. Talk about those years in Germany and that time in the armed services and kind of how that changed you.
Oh, my gosh. I was a second lieutenant. I reported to my unit. It was the 18th Infantry. I was there for 9 weeks. I went in one morning after 9 weeks. It was on a Monday morning, and my first sergeant said, "Lieutenant, you've got to report to battalion headquarters." I never went to battalion. I mean, that was like 1,000 miles away, and went there, and they said, "You've been transferred to the 3rd Battalion, 68th Armor." And 20 minutes later, I was headed there, and it was a tank unit, and I was going to be an officer in a tank battalion, and I had never seen a tank.
First tank you'd ever seen, and you're an officer.
And I was in command of five of them.
Wow.
And so off I went, and what an adventure that was.
It sounds like it. Now, when all's said and done, though, you come back to Little Rock.
Yeah, I stayed in the Army, and then I went to the University of Heidelberg for a year.
I was going to say, you went to grad school in Germany.
I went to grad school. Okay. I got an overseas discharge, and I applied, and I was very surprised when I got accepted, but I did. So I matriculated there for a year, and then came back to Little Rock after I got out.
All right, and what drove your decision to come back here, and then what did you do in those early Arkansas years of your career?
Well, I never thought about living anywhere else. I mean, I like Arkansas, and I was really happy here. And with where my family was, there was a place that I knew, and I had lots of friends here. But when I was in college, I had been president of the Student Senate, and I started an organization called Arkansas Careers because they were trying to get college graduates to stay here, but nobody wanted to stay here because Arkansas had been just really made to look bad in that integration crisis in 57-58.
Yeah.
So I started it when I was there, but then I was out of the country for 3 years. And when I came back, when Rockefeller talked to me about taking over Arkansas Careers, and he said he'd put the money up to back it.
Oh, wow.
So I went to work for Arkansas Careers trying to keep college graduates in Arkansas. And over 2 years, I spoke to every single Rotary Club, I believe that's right, in Arkansas.
Yeah, you were
plus
all over the
all
state.
All over the place. Lions, Kiwanis, church groups,
yep.
Student groups, and everything. Made hundreds, literally about 250 speeches. And I got to know Arkansas. Well, when I went to towns, I would talk to the people. Usually it was a Rotary Club, and I would talk to the people in the club, and they would tell me about what's going on. And I got a whole different picture of Arkansas from what I was reading in the papers. I mean, the main thing was that most everybody I talked to, with two or three exceptions, all of which I remember, was for the integration, bringing blacks fully into the white life in Arkansas. And they were embarrassed by what had happened.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, in every little town and hamlet in Arkansas, I went to all of them. And it was a revelation for me to see that.
We recently, and that had to be, I'm a bit younger, so I was a child then, I don't have clear memories of that era, Porter, but you mentioned Winthrop Rockefeller, and we recently spent a day for a column you're going to see. I went with Porter to the Arkansas Delta and spent a day, but we were talking, and as a history nut, I happen to believe that it took Rockefeller to start, and then Dale Bumpers came after him. I think our two best governors were probably back to back, and it was really in that 8-year period, I believe, that Arkansas went from the old South to the new South, really. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. Well, right. Yeah.
But you were in such a period of change for our state.
It was. I mean, think about it. Brown versus Board of Education
comes
in 1954.
Then we have the 57 crisis.
65, the voter registry.
Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act. Yeah, 64.
And then Wynn got elected
in 66.
But the big thing was that Wynn Rockefeller put all these blacks on state boards and commissions in his first term and got reelected.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got a line in the book, and it says, with Wynn Rockefeller's reelection, Jim Crow in Arkansas was ended forever.
Yeah, absolutely.
The next line says, and after that, no Arkansas governor had any intercourse with segregation.
Yeah.
It was done, finished, and gone.
Absolutely. I was on a radio show, I'll never forget, on New Year's Eve in 1999. So we kind of end of the millennium, end of the century. And it was here in Little Rock. And so they asked me, they said, the most important person of the century in Arkansas, Bill Clinton's in the White House at this point. They expected me to say Bill Clinton.
I said
Wynn Rockefeller, because I said, by beating Jim Johnson in 66, and then you mentioned 68, Marion Crank, another member of the old guard, beating him, Rockefeller forced the dominant party at the time, the Democrats, to change, to put off the shackles of segregation. So it was a Rockefeller that made a Dale Bumpers, a David Pryor, and yes, a Bill Clinton possible.
Amen, amen, amen. And Rockefeller is the most historic governor in Arkansas, not because they were Republican or anything, but because he put segregation out of our lives forever.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you mentioned your work in speaking all over the state, but you also you've always had broad interests. So you started hospital association, catfish farming, a lot of things during those Little Rock years there.
Yeah. Well, I started a business to manage nonprofit corporations,
right,
and the ones where the action was were trade associations.
Mm-hmm.
And I lucked into two of them, the catfish farmers and the for-profit hospitals.
Yeah.
And ran that business for 12 years.
And at the same time, you were a pioneer. I could talk for, we're not going to go for an hour, but I really could because we've got so many shared interests. I love historic preservation, restoration. People didn't think about that back then. I mean, the 60s, 70s, we tore down buildings very quickly. But you were a real pioneer here in Arkansas in the preservation movement, finally saying we've got to stop tearing down buildings and looking at rehabilitating.
I don't know if I was a pioneer or not, but I got elected to the board of the Quapaw Quarter. I had become, sort of a little bit prominent in town, and so they elected me to the board when my wife and I moved down to the Quapaw Quarter, and I proposed all these things we should do, and they didn't reelect me because they didn't want to do it. So I staged a coup. Carl Miller, Charles Witzel, Francis Ross, and a few others, and we took over.
What a great group. I still serve with Francis on the Historic Arkansas Museum Commission, and Charles served on that commission when I first started.
So, oh, my gosh.
What a great group of people.
Well, yeah. It was. And Carl Miller is a great preservationist. And I provoked it. The transition, and they took it over and led it. I mean, I was a provocateur in this case, and they were more established and distinguished, but they were very reputable people, and I was the guy who had made a lot of people mad by provoking this coup d'etat, so they were all up front, and
yeah,
I did. I ran the membership campaign.
Yeah.
We increased the membership from 65 to 600.
Wow.
In 4 months.
Of the Quapaw Quarter Association.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
600. Yeah. But I want you to get south towards home because it's a fascinating book. I don't want to steal too much from them, but got to get into this. Your career then takes you to the West Coast. It takes you to the East Coast. Give us a summary of how that happened. You're well established in Arkansas, well established in Little Rock, but suddenly you're running campaigns, doing different things on the West Coast and then the East Coast.
Well, I had something called a defalcation, which is a misuse of funds where the person doesn't steal it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's embezzlement without theft, and ended up losing my whole business.
Wow.
When I was 40 years old, and I sued a local bank and eventually won, but it took me 3.5 years to get my day in court.
Yeah.
So off I went, and I had been traveling a lot, particularly with the Hospital Association for 11 years, all over California, New York.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to move to California and did. And not long after I got there, I ended up being asked to lead a political campaign, which I did, and it was an issue campaign. And I ended up working with Paul Newman.
It was an anti-nuclear campaign.
It was called the Nuclear Freeze Campaign.
Okay.
And I didn't really believe in the idea because I didn't trust the Soviet Union on any basis. But I needed a job, frankly.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
I lost everything. I mean, I ended up going Chapter 7 bankrupt.
Did you really?
I did. Yeah. In 1981.
Yeah.
Lost everything. Had to start over from scratch. And I was talking to this guy on this other thing I was working on, and he said, let's forget what you're talking about. I want you to run this campaign. He said, we need somebody that nobody knows, who knows how to get things done and who knows how to follow orders. This guy had been a Marine.
Yeah.
And he was 70, in his mid-70s. And so I ran the campaign for a year.
And suddenly you're working with Paul Newman on a daily basis.
For 8 months. We were together every day.
Wow. And,
he's a great guy.
I was going to say, tell me about Paul Newman, what he was like as a person.
He was the best joke teller I've ever encountered.
Really?
The second best was Dale Bumpers.
Bumpers was great. Yeah, he'd probably be at the top of my list, but I never met Paul Newman.
Paul Newman was a really lovely man, and he had a great heart, and he would do anything for this issue. I mean, he was more liberal than I was. But we got along fine, but we argued about our issues, and kind of he came to where he is and I came to where I was, and we respected one another and went on. But what a fun guy he was. Well, really nice man.
Mm-hmm. You know,
genuinely a civilized person, and never dogmatic, always had an open mind. I mean, he generally came down just slightly left of center on everything.
Yeah.
But was a great guy.
Yeah.
Great guy. And that led to my working with this guy in San Francisco. His picture's in my book, and the South Towards Home, named Jim Hickman, who was the greatest innovator I had ever met. And his area was, he was working with people in the Soviet Union, trying to bring them to the Western ways. And he and I started working together, excuse me. And eventually Jim said that it was time. The time was right to try to take a pop star to Russia. They never would let anybody famous come over there and get any attention.
Right, right.
So Jim said John Denver was the guy. So I ended up going to Aspen and pitching John on and performing in the Soviet Union and in Moscow and Leningrad. They now call Leningrad St. Petersburg. But anyway, so we worked that out and got Pepsi to finance it. And that
so you go from working with Paul Newman to working with John Denver.
I know. Yeah. It is something. And John and I became very good friends and spent years together. And a great guy he was.
Yeah.
He was a great guy. And there's a great story in the book about we had to convince the Soviet leaders in Washington to let John come.
Mm-hmm.
And so we set up a meeting one night for John and Jim Hickman, the guy who was the genius behind it all, and me, to meet with these people from the Soviet embassy. There was an ambassador and everybody, and Jim said, those are not the people with the power. The people with the power are people hidden away down here.
Mm-hmm.
So
the quiet ones. Yeah.
The quiet ones. So we had a meeting. We set it up one evening for the two guys that were the powers that be in the Soviet Union, and we got word at the last minute that they were going to bring their wives, which never happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so we met at this home. There was eight of us, the four of them, Jim, John, and me, and the other guy from the Soviet embassy who took us there, and who was Jim's friend, Andre was his name. And at that in this home where we met, John was there, and the woman said, one of the wives said, you know, well, would you sing for us? And John said, sure, what do you want to sing? And she said, Annie's song. And she knew all of his songs. And so he started singing it, and this woman started crying.
Must have been. Yeah.
And the next day, the Soviets invited John to come play in Moscow and Leningrad.
Wow.
Very cool. It was an honor to be there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So and I'm thinking here, you have gone from leading this tank battalion in Germany during the early Cold War to now suddenly you're sitting in Moscow.
I know.
Talk about an interesting journey.
Yeah, what a turn of events. Yeah. I was in Moscow actually the earlier time when I was involved in historic preservation.
Okay.
The United Nations had a conference there on historic preservation, and I was invited to speak because I was publishing this magazine that I started on historic preservation. So
yeah.
Several times I was there.
So then you end up doing work on the East Coast. How did you get east in Wall Street?
Well, when we finished John's concerts, I got involved with some guys in New York that had a company that had a software that helped people trade in U.S. government bonds, government securities, mm-hmm. we call them. And so they were trying to get more customers in California, and I was living in Los Angeles. And so I went out and got every customer they wanted in California.
Gotcha.
And they said, why don't you move to New York and run this for the whole country? I moved there, and within months, they sold the company to Drexel Burnham Lazare,
yep,
which was the junk bond company.
And exactly.
I ended up working for Drexel for almost 6 years.
And you were there when it all fell apart.
Right? I was there when it fell apart, and they went bankrupt.
Yep.
But they were the most profitable company in the world. They had a guy running their junk bond operation named Michael Melkin, who was a true genius. I say in the book, I've met two business geniuses in my life, Michael Milken and Jack Stevens.
Here in Little Rock. Interesting.
They were staggering intelligence.
Yeah.
And both of them were nice guys. Milken's a little colder than Jack.
Yeah.
But Jack was very shy, too.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Anyway, so I've worked for Drexel and traveled everywhere. I went everywhere in the world. They wanted me to go to Abidjan, the capital of Ivory Coast. I said, I ain't going there. I didn't want to go to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't. But everywhere else I went.
Yeah. And like I said, I could talk about this for hours, but I try to keep these to about 30 minutes. So I'm going to go forward a little bit now. Like I said, get the books out towards home. But what finally brings you home to Little Rock after all these adventures?
Well, when I left New York, I went through a period of great healing, including doing psychotherapy for 20 months.
Mm.
And then Clinton got elected, and
right.
a lot of people from Arkansas moved, like 100 people moved up to Washington.
Believe me, I was political editor of this newspaper. Yeah. We were writing about all of them.
Yeah, right. And so I started going into Washington, and a lot of them were friends, and I know how to behave and go to fancy parties, and I know how to dance. So I would take female friends of mine, to parties, and they would be the distinguished so-and-so, the honorable so-and-so. And so I did that, and then finally decided I'd been living in the Virginia countryside
mm-hmm.
after I left New York for almost 5 years. So I decided to move to Washington and start a business. So I started a business there and built it up. After 10, 11 years, I was introduced to my wife and we met and began to date. And
gotcha.
I'd been single for 22 years. I was divorced. So we got married, and I moved home.
Mm.
I had a business.
What year was that now?
That was in 2009.
Okay.
And I moved the headquarters of my business. By that time, we had 17 offices in the U.S. and Canada, and we did specialize in passports. And I moved the headquarters down here and bought a building up on Kavanaugh across from the Old Heights Theater.
Yep.
And that's how I got back to Arkansas. Thank the Lord.
Well, I want to close with this. This is not in the book, but you're going to be reading about it because I'm going to write about it. But one of the things I love, Porter, is you talk about you hit 80 and you're officially old, but you are not slowing down. And a region that I write about a lot because most people have written it off is the Arkansas Delta. Mm-hmm. And you, unlike few of my fellow Arkansans, see the potential, and you've got a vision for the Arkansas Delta, and I just have a feeling it's going to be your last great act because you do have a vision for that place.
So do I.
Yeah.
So do I. The Delta has an incredible assets, a tourist asset, mm-hmm. all tourist assets. I mean, Civil War tourism, civil rights tourism, water trailing, hiking, biking, the blues, and I've got a plan that I'm going to carry out, and it's a big plan, as I've told you.
Yeah.
We've talked about it privately.
And you told me that you think that people in kayaks and canoes on water trails within a few years will be one of our main outdoor recreational pursuits here in Arkansas.
It will be as big as bicycling.
Wow.
I told you a while back
And we've already seen Tom and Stuart Walton making Arkansas the cycling capital of America. Now.
Well, what we have over there in the Delta, I mean, just one, well, it's an extraordinary example, but we have trees that near Brinkley and a place called Bayou de Vue, it's a swamp, basically, that trees that are 1,200 years old.
Unbelievable.
And they've proven that by looking at the cycles on the trees that were cut down.
Yeah, they're to us what the redwoods are to Northern California. Yeah.
And the other thing is that I'm working with Raymond Abramson, Judge Abramson, over in Holly Grove.
One of my favorite people in Arkansas.
Gosh, he
has been on this podcast, by the way.
He's a great man. And we're working to help kids over there that are likely to end up in criminality, and we're really making a difference. And it's in Holly Grove and Clarendon, and recently we added Marianna to it, and we're moving.
Yeah.
So the Delta is in a state of change.
Yeah.
There's things that are needed, but we're dealing with them.
And like I said, where others see a big problem and just kind of want to write it off, what I love, Porter, is you do see the potential. And outdoor recreation certainly is going to be a bigger part of our economy in Arkansas going forward, I'm convinced.
It is, and especially with digital marketing, it's so easy to get the word out there. If you've got a great asset, you can do videos and pictures and tell brief stories online, and you can make miracles happen in months.
Yeah, absolutely. Porter, thank you so much. I'm going to get you back because you got so many tales to tell, and I'm glad you're still out there. But, again, the book is South Towards Home by Porter Briggs. Believe me, it is quite a journey. You're going to enjoy it. World's most interesting man, and he's right here in Little Rock.
Buy it at a bookstore.
Hey, I couldn't have found anybody else that would put Jack Stevens and Michael Milken in the same sentence together. You know, great stuff. So, Porter, thanks for joining us. And, go to a bookstore and get a copy of this. I promise you'll enjoy it.
Thank you, Rex.
Yes, sir. Thank you for joining us for yet another edition of the Southern Pride Podcast, a production of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette.